then it's just like P P equals 0.053.
Oh!
No!
Treasures of the past, it will always seem like a glowing dream. But so, honey, won't you let me in? I said, honey, won't you let me in?
Welcome, St. Andrews and science fans from around the world, to the fourth episode of our science-based podcast, Facts Naturally. I am Dan Ray, and as always, I'm joined by David Pritchard.
It's nice to be here, Dan.
And Zach Cole.
In a world seemingly forever ravaged by Dans and Davids, I am humanity's last hope.
It's drama queen.
Listeners, today are in for a real treat, because today is the day we get to talk about bees.
Bees!
I've wanted to do this episode for quite some time now. I wanted to talk about the bees because, as most of you already know, or what I've heard of, the bees are dying. Dying around the world, the bees are. Looking at North America, the bee population has more than halved in the last 50 years, and things are looking much better over in Europe. There's estimates that the bee population has dropped by 30% in the UK in the last 5 years. And over in Italy, the same time period, an estimated mortality rate of 50% of the bees. In Scotland, there was one report that in 2009, 80% of some of the beekeeping stations in the north have lost 80% of their bees. Over in Germany, 40% have been dying, and in Switzerland, 50% have died.
Oh, nice.
It is weird, because it is like the only kind of real disaster of this kind where you hear is just like a blanket thing over all the all the species involved, instead of just like, you usually hear about like a species, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are those that point out that bee populations go up and down naturally, pun, but I think it's fairly unanimously agreed across scientists around the world that bee populations are dropping faster than they usually do. What's more scary is that there's no real consensus about why the bees are dying. So bee deaths, or the high degree of bee deaths, have been termed colony collapse disorder. Colony collapse disorder. And that's just a blanket term because they don't really know why bees are dying. You might be wondering how they estimate that the bees are dying out. They can't count them one by one. So what they do is they go and look at the colonies. They go and look at the hives. And if the hives have been abandoned and there's still larvae and there's still honey and there's still pollen in the hive, then you can tell that the colony has just collapsed. It's not as though they've picked up and moved to a better place because they've left all the honey behind. Also, if there is a queen bee and no workers present, it shows that the colony hasn't just moved to a different hive. They're just dying.
Or mutiny.
Or mutiny.
That's true.
Yep. Also, if the hive pests, such as their old friendly wax moth, making another appearance in this week's episode.
The delicious, romantic wax moth.
If hive pests such as the wax moths or hive beetles show no real interest in a colony, it's probably because there's no need to go in there.
Hive beetles is the mashup I'm waiting for still.
Yeah.
So what's the cause of colony collapse disorder? Well, that's the scariest part. Most scientists can't really come to a consensus about what causes colony collapse disorder. There's been many suggestions. There's been insect disease, malnutrition, environmental change related, so sort of global warming aspects. Most recently in 2013, there's been a formal review published by the European Food and Safety Authority, and they state that the use of pesticides...
And they stated that, no, you shouldn't eat bees.
That's what
unsafe.
I've done a lot.
This is why you're in charge of what I eat.
Unsafe. 2013, the European Food and Safety Authority stated that it was pesticides, neonicotinoid pesticides... I butchered that one, that are causing colony collapse disorder, but that's not entirely a consensus point of view. Other pesticides could be the problem here, or as I said before, it could be environmentally related, or just a random fluctuation in bee populations.
Well, it could be lots of things, right? It could be like a little bit of all of these things.
Yeah, so I think what most scientists come to accept upon, anyway, is that colony collapse disorder is a combination of all of these factors, and not just one single cause.
So it's not just pesticides and mites, it's also aliens and mobile phones.
And go!
We'll go
somewhere. Well, no, it's under mobile phones.
Yeah.
And extraterrestrials, really. Yeah,
because I was reading on a UFO website that the aliens are taking the bees for the honey, which they're going to use to rejuvenate their skin.
That UFO website, I believe, is Science Daily?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's it.
On a more serious note, but not really, there's the speculation that mobile phones are causing the death of the bees too.
Ah,
yep. It's because they charge so much every month, right?
they're killing
with navigation.
That's a speculated cause as well. There are many speculated causes. Many speculated causes about why bees are dying, but probably they just don't want to be here anymore. They don't want to be here anymore.
So they're killing themselves. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. That's a really dark interpretation. Good, yeah.
Hey guys, here's a pun. Bees are committing suicide. Get it?
Because they don't want to be alive.
Colony collapses.
They hive to die.
I don't know if you guys are as concerned about it, but if colony collapse order continues, the amount of bee ghosts that we're going to be facing in the next 2 to 3 years.
That's, I think, why scientists are worried about this. There's the problem with pollination, but bee ghosts can only carry 1/3 as much pollen as a regular bee, a living bee.
Well, I'm just concerned because if you were talking about cell phones, were you saying that we should be worried for our cell phones because of bee ghosts? Or is it the other way around?
What about energy parasites? Where are they? Anyway, we'll leave that. Call back. Anyway,
Be sure to tune into episode 2 of Fact Naturally, where we talked about energy parasites.
Dan has a best mental index. I don't even know who you people are.
Minute 48. Also, a big problem about bee deaths are that bees pollinate many of the crops used around the world, and if they can't do that, then we don't get the crops. And many people suspect, and by many I mean not very many at all, suspect that humans will die out as a cause of bee death. That's likely to be speculative. But that will be the topic for today will be bees.
Will be humans dying from bees.
Actually, that will make up the third segment.
My topic rejected.
But we will talk about, stay tuned for killer bees, which is what I really wanted to talk about. So colony collapse disorder, it sucks.
And what is the theme? Sorry, I interrupted you.
The theme is bees.
Exclamation mark.
So we're going to have a short break, and then we're going to cut it over to David. What are you going to tell us about, David?
I'm going to tell us about how, before the colony collapses, they exist as a unit. Some people say superorganism. And how does a superorganism make a decision?
I think they're all right. I don't know if I would call them super.
They're a pretty, pretty fine organism. And how does a colony of thousands of bees make a decision that the whole hive has to go with?
So stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Back. So, as we kind of hinted before the break, I was going to talk to you about bee societies and how they make decisions. So, to give a kind of a brief introduction to bee societies, honeybees, at least, and some other types of bees, some other types of wasps, and some types of ants, but not all, live in what we would call eusocial societies, where a lot of the workers don't breed. They work for the benefit of the group. And only the queen will mate and produce offspring.
That's like us, and Dan doesn't breed because of his face.
Yep. Basically, that's it. Science. So, the reason for this is actually due to, I wouldn't say a quirk, but a difference is in the genetics of sex determination in bees and, for example, some other species. So, in us, in mammals, all mammals have two, or in the case of some super rats, more than two copies of each chromosome.
Sorry, wait, what?
Yeah, what's a super rat?
So there are some rats.
He's gonna brush past super rats.
there's at least two species of rat that have four copies of every chromosome, and they are.
Sounds
I think
like
they're bigger than other rats.
Are you sure that they didn't just accidentally run two rats at the same time?
I don't think they ran them into one another.
They just rammed them into each other.
These tests are replicable.
So when you have two copies of every chromosome, it's called diploid, in that diploid. Being chromosome, you've got two, right? Whereas if you only have one copy, you're haploid, and then you have half as much. So bees, this is different in the different sexes. So an unfertilized egg that's just hatched, laid by the queen bee, if it's unfertilized, it just has one set of chromosomes, it's haploid, it just becomes a male. That's where males come from. If it's fertilized and a male puts his DNA in there as well, there's now two sets of DNA, diploid, and that becomes a female.
So the males are just genetic clones of the queen.
Kind of, yes. But haploid genetic clones of the queen.
Well, and then if one egg is laid and three male come and put their genetic material in it, you get a super rat.
That is basically how biology works. The males, so the unfertilized eggs that become males are known as drones, whereas the females can be workers or they can be queens. So that's how that comes about. So interestingly, if you're a male bee, you don't have a father and you will never have any sons, but you will have grandsons and you do have a grandfather. That's something to mull on. So because of this, if you have the offspring of a single male and a single queen, all of the sisters, so the female children, offspring of that, will all share exactly the same chromosomes for the male, right? But only have half of the chromosomes of the queen bee. This means that the sisters are 75% related to each other. So they've already 50% related just based on the male.
Oh, okay, absolutely.
And then they have half of the female's contribution, so that's 25%. You add them together, and you have 75%. They, compared to their own offspring, if they were to be a queen, just decide, I'm going to be a queen, and have an offspring, they would only be 50% related to it. So in terms of evolutionary genetics, it makes sense for them to... They can pass on more of their genes by producing more sisters than they would by producing more offspring.
Oh.
And that is how one reason why it thought that this kind of complex society where they all kind of cooperate evolved. Now the story's a little bit more complicated. I won't get into that.
Sorry, if you had if you compared it to like a human family structure,
you'd have to look
would
at
they
Louisiana.
Be like yeah would they be considered like comparable to like a sibling or
the
like with that level of genetic relatedness, or is it like
so? 75% is closer than any
yeah,
human.
I was gonna say, I guess
so. In humans, you're 50% related to your siblings and to your parents.
You would have to have an offspring with your sister to have somebody who is 75% your makeup, I think,
or at least to break 50.
Yeah.
Mm. So they're more related to.
I'm sorry, incest joke. Continue.
They're more related to their own sisters, as we said, and to their own offspring. That's why this is stable. However, it's a bit more complicated than that. There are, for example, this relies on there being only one male mating with the queen, when that's not necessarily always the case. And there are cases where there are non-sexual males helping out. So it's a little bit more complicated, but this basic idea seems to be fairly robust, although some people have said it doesn't work anymore. But regardless of that.
So it's the genetic relatedness underlying the sociality?
Yes, potentially. So if they think about the animal's behaviour is driven by trying to pass on as many of its genes as possible, it can do that by producing more sisters than it can by producing its own offspring.
Yeah, so it's really counterintuitive to think that you might want... So, like, you are happy with someone else surviving because they are passing on the same genes that are within you.
Yeah.
So Hamilton's rule, if I remember biology, was you shouldn't act altruistically unless the odds of your survival or the odds of your genes being passed on are higher than that of the act you're going to make. Can you explain
yes,
it better?
Basically. So Hamilton's rule is the amount of cost that you'd be willing to incur on yourself is related to the benefit that it would give, corrected for relatedness to those that you who would benefit. So if you were to sacrifice yourself for, say, three siblings, the genetic benefit in terms of the likely... each sibling is 50% related to you. Three times 50%, because three siblings are saved, with a 50% chance of having a gene in it, say, this is a very simplified view, would produce more than the cost, which is 1, because 1.5 to 1.
So for those of you scoring at home, if R is greater than BC, then you should make that action. But I'm not going to define what those constants are.
No, it's C is greater than... It's C is less than RB.
Yep. So in humans, you couldn't really mate with your family members because you lose the genetic diversity.
Well, that happens in all animals, right?
Yeah.
So how do the bees and moles or whatever species do this? How do they survive?
In terms of mating, they don't mate with their sisters, in that they work to produce more sisters. So the males that are coming in are not the males that are produced from the queen. The queen
right.
doesn't mate with her own sons.
Right.
But other males come in.
So it isn't actually.
Of them are mating with each other. They're
I was going to say it's all like sisters.
There's no incest.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As much as it is kind of like celibate devotion to the family group.
Just a lot of step bros
yeah.
and sisses.
But anyway, so getting back on, so this has been one they put forward, and it's a very influential idea about why they cooperate together, but it can be difficult cooperating together. An individual out in the world foraging and making decisions, it goes out and it samples information and it can make a decision, and that seems very simple. But if you have a whole hive of bees and they have to go out and sample information and make decisions, how does that many bees come to make not only a decision, but in many cases the best decision? So this idea of swarm intelligence has actually been quite well studied in these species, first in the 50s and then later in the 90s and 2000s, where we are at the moment. And it looks at how through individuals who don't all know the same thing, you can reach these kind of optimal decisions. So one example is how bees together can choose the best nectar sources to go for, or how when a swarm is flying around, only 5% of those bees know where they're going, yet they're guiding the rest of the swarm. So, but what I thought I'd talk about is a particularly well-studied example, which is how do bees choose where to have their next nest?
Is it the waggle dance?
The waggle dance is involved. So basically what happens is when the bees are tired of their old nest, when they're finished with their old nest, they all leave. The whole swarm leaves and they turn into a ball.
And then they turn into like pointing fingers, arrows, and...
It's over there!
Sting Bugs Bunny.
But they all fall into this ball and they kind of hang themselves from tree branches.
Oh my god, what are we talking about bees wanting to bee not again? Be here anymore?
Not hang themselves in that way.
I promise that the theme wasn't supposed to be bee suicide.
And yet. they basically become this... They all kind of like join together into this kind of mass and then hang themselves from a branch. It's very weird.
I've seen pictures. You can see pictures of it online.
Look for this online, listeners.
It's just like a solid wall of moving bees.
It is bizarre. It's like,
you wouldn't want to
come across
it. It's
like it's dripping. It's not dripping, but it's very strange to look at. But while they're there, they send out scout bees, specially designated, to look for sites. And they will come back and they will do the waggle dance, which I'll describe in a little bit more detail later, about the sites that they've found. You can see this on the surface of this ball of bees. And over time, they first of all, they start off advertising all kinds of different directions. But over the course of 2 or 3 days, all the bees will be dancing for the same site in the same location, at which point the entire swarm takes off and flies over to it.
How come they don't just find the site before they leave the first nest?
I don't know.
You
wouldn't get this cool bee ball if that didn't...
I was going to ask, is the point of the bee ball like thermoregulation? Like, I just...
Possibly.
Yeah, have to stay warm. Because I imagine it's probably pretty extreme to all of a sudden not
be in the hive.
They
might even be carrying the larvae with them. I'm not too sure about that.
Presumably they must be, yeah. Mm. That's a good point.
So anyway, there's so they've got their bee ball going on. But then this has intrigued people. So this is first described in the 50s. That the bees would, as soon as we understood the waggle dance, we were able to kind of look at bees and see what they were advertising. And people saw on the surface that the bees, just with a piece of paper and a pencil, were noting down, the bees suddenly started all agreeing with each other about where to go, and then they headed off in that direction. And recently, not that recently, but in the 90s, some work was done to see whether they actually were choosing the best location. So the best new nest for a bee, it has to be over 10 litres volume on the inside, but have an entrance of less than 30 centimetres in diameter.
And if it has a pool.
Yeah, that's also important.
And enough parking.
They gotta check for the neighbours.
Yeah, and it has to be like shopping adjacent. But there's... and they actually... So they did this experimentally by taking these bees out onto an island and providing... like several different possible nest locations.
They took these bees out to an island and gave them all small straw hats and Hawaiian shirts.
And then, but they still killed themselves. Now, and they found out that the bees significantly chose, when the whole swarm took off, they significantly chose the best of the available nests.
What do they mean by best?
The ones which that had the most internal
criteria.
Volume and they... And,
yeah. And a good school district.
Good school, yeah, exactly. Great transit links. The bees are obviously making quite a smart decision, and it's a significant decision, right? And it's so how is this happening? Well, it seems to be that on the surface of the ball, you rather than having individual scouts, so the scouts fly out and they find sites, But multiple scouts will actually find the same site and they'll come back and they'll both advertise it. So it's not individual scouts advertising, but you have kind of almost coalitions of scouts, each advertising a type, and they're competing with each other to attract uncommitted scouts, scouts that haven't made up their mind about what they want to dance for yet.
Like real estate agents.
Yeah, basically.
Or political parties.
Yeah, exactly. And they, over the course of this decision, they are aiming to recruit more scouts to their coalition and get the other one, and to abandon less, as it were. So recruit more, abandon less, and try to get the others to recruit less and abandon more. And over time, this results in all the bees doing the same thing. Now, the way that they get them to recruit more is that if you find a really good site, you dance more. Now, the waggle dance, as we've been talking about, was first studied in terms of navigation. So the bees would find a cool flower, fly back to the hive, and do a dance that told the other bees where it was. It's kind of like a figure of eight, but the middle part of the figure of eight, in between the two circles, is a kind of a series of waggles. Yeah, so the bee does a series of kind of slightly diagonal wiggles down it, and that's called a waggle.
There's also a pop music phase in the 50s.
Apparently.
I do it in the club.
How else do you think we found all that nectar in the 50s?
That's true.
You can find me in the club doing waggle dance. Come on, give me a hug. Boom, boom, boom.
That is not from the 50s. Also, for the past minute, we've all been waggling while talking.
So they have these dances with the waggle runs, and
last week I had a mad case of the waggle runs. I'm sorry.
I can't remember exactly how the distance is encoded, but the kind of the angle of the waggle run section in the middle of the figure eight indicates a direction.
Yeah, it's like actually pointed, relative to the sun. It's actually the direction of where.
So it's directional. So it actually tells them where something is. But if you find a really good site, you do your dance, which you don't do continuously, but it has more waggle runs. You'll dance for longer, and you'll have a longer waggle run section, so you'll have a bigger dance. So those who find a really good site, so a site that best meets their specifications, are dancing longer and livelier, as it were.
So if you find like a, you know, the B equivalent of like a slum or the projects or something, you just do like a half-ass waggle dance?
Yeah, basically. Your dance isn't as long and it doesn't have as many waggle runs in it. So the other thing is that regardless of what you found, bees lose motivation to dance the longer that they do it. So
sense regardless, because no matter what, you don't want to be doing it forever.
No, but you dance and they'll go out and they'll revisit it and they'll come back in and they'll dance again and they'll go out and revisit it and they'll dance again. But every time they're dancing less. And this is a very stable linear thing. So each time they're doing about 15 less waggle runs, regardless of where the site is. But, and I just want to point out, this is known as the motivation to dance in German is called Tanzlust, which means dance lust. And it's a word I think we should be using much more in our vocabulary.
I got some Tanzlust right now.
Yeah, I know.
Waggle.
So basically,
my new electronic EP, Tanzlust.
They have this kind of system in which the bees that find the really good sites start off at a higher level of dancing. And so as they all lose their Tanzlust at kind of the same amount, they will be the ones who are dancing longer and dominate more.
They might be the only ones dancing.
The ones that once you've fully lost your dance lust, you kind of abandon dancing.
You hang yourself
and you become you become one of the you abandon your advertising and you become one of the uncommitted bees.
Oh my god, that is the most terrifying population of bees, the uncommitted.
Over time, this leads to the best sites being advertised, because they're advertised longer and the other ones are abandoning bees more readily. The best sites recruit more bees to them. They don't have to understand anything about it. You can just have the bees sampling randomly and they will still choose the best.
Yeah, it's just it's a product of them doing more and longer and then recruiting more.
Exactly. A product of them recruiting, of just being more available and the other ones kind of running out of steam.
So how long does this process take?
So this occurs over like 2 or 3 days. And it's interesting, if you look at map where the bees are kind of pointing, as they were in their dances, it can change dramatically over that time. So the first dances they're advertised may well be incomplete, like the ones that have the largest coalition of dancers at the beginning is not necessarily the one that the bees end up going to. So they kind of run out of steam and stuff. When you advertise your location, like the scout bees that are following you and go like, hey, that guy's dancing over there, they go out and have a look, right? And they come back, and if they agree, that's when they kind of join in and they've recruited to your dance. So it's, they can't get this kind of positive feedback wherein they see a crappy dance and they do... they see a dance for a crappy site, so
crappy,
they do it.
A crappy dance. The variant of the waggle dance that never caught on.
They see like a... So that kind of corrects for it, having a runaway process where bees see a dance for a bad site and they dance for it, which means more bees are dancing for it, which means more bees are dancing for it. They actually do go out and check. This way you can get everyone to be kind of redirected towards the best sites really quickly, and over a course of 3 days get all of the bees pointing in the same direction, at which point the hive leaves and they will have found the best place.
To recap, when a bee or a bee colony wants to find a new hive, they abandon the old hive, make this wall of bees that hang from a tree, send out some scouts. The competing scouts, like real estate agents, sort of do their waggle dance.
I'm sorry, did you not watch Step Up 3?
It is basically this is basically the plot of Step Up 3D.
Right now, see my waggle. What was I saying? Oh yeah, so the scouts go out there, they go check out the locations. The best wagglers get some more scouts to go follow them, and then there's a general consensus over
it's
time.
It's just like, it's one really simple principle that ends up deciding the fate or the type of behavior of a group.
There's a kind of a basic behavioral rule in which...
So it is like Step Up, dance off.
It's a basic behavioral rule for basic people.
Yeah,
they have a dance off to see whose location's better.
Why do you have to wear a bandana? I don't get it.
So this process, this swarm intelligence in which you have multiple individuals kind of looking at each other and making the best decision through the following fairly simple behavioral rules.
Does anything happen to the bees that they don't listen to? Like the scouts who pick the wrong location? Do they get exiled?
Well, presumably they stop.
They just basically run out of juice.
And then once they do that, they're impressionable towards other dancers.
So there seems to be some work that they don't run out of motivation because they know that it's bad compared to others. It just seems to be they just run out of motivation to dance. Yeah. They lose their Tanzlust. And this idea, swarm intelligence, has then been taking off in robotics and computer science and physics in terms of modelling self-organisation and all kinds of stuff. So
if I had
it's
a
quite
dollar,
a cool thing to be looking at.
If I had a dollar for every time I misused my Tanzlust.
Lust.
Oh God, what have I been using?
Anyway, so that's how... When you're trapped together with your sisters, all trying to get on with one another, this is how you dance your problems out, and you'll eventually all agree.
And then if you win, you can say you suckers get served.
Yeah. I think it shows how you have this evolutionary situation where you are working for the good of the group. You can kind of get around this complicated idea of making decisions for the group without, you know, being psychic or anything like that. You can, things work out.
Yeah, and they don't have to actively be knowing what they're doing.
No, exactly, and they still make really, really intelligent decisions.
I think we're going to take a quick break, and then I will be back with the next segment.
What are you going to talk about?
What am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk about the fact that it took us until 2005, at which point science finally declared confidently that bees can fly. We'll be right back.
Till then, walk this town like an asshole. Mother.
All right, so we are back, and I am going to talk about, again, how it took us so long to confidently aver that scientifically, yes, bees can fly.
I thought so.
I'm still not convinced. I'm hoping Zach will convince me.
Well, so I should ask, have either of you ever heard of this problem? The concept of bee
Where
flight has actually been somewhat of a folky myth in science, and that science can't explain why bees fly. I looked up, and it looks like there's a couple sources. The earliest kind of recollections of it, you can find some accounts that talk about origins in German technical universities, where at a dinner a biologist asked an aerodynamics expert about insect flight. And so just kind of on the back of his napkin, using the aerodynamic theories of the time, looking at stuff like air resistance, and bumblebee mass, they're looking at bumblebees in particular, they concluded that bee flight was impossible. They basically were saying that there's no way a bumblebee could generate sufficient lift for its body mass.
At which point, all around the world, bumblebees fell to the ground.
Now, in conjunction with this, to be a little bit more formal, the first time this idea was ever put into words was by Two French scientists, Auguste Magne and André Salagru.
You're Canadian, you can do better than that.
It was in a French text on insects, and they actually went on record as a quote saying, bumblebee flight is impossible.
They've just been gliding for all this time.
Yeah, exactly. So this story has very strongly embedded itself in science folklore, if you will. So bees became a model of the inadequacy of aerodynamic theory. So it was a constant driving force that we're missing something. We can't explain this. In addition to that, it's also a good example now of the shamelessness of theorists when they're commenting on the natural world.
Yeah, and
so insofar that they just basically said something that's been happening for as long as humans have been alive is impossible. And it's even used by some creationists as an example of scientific inadequacy. So basically, that science can't explain why bees fly. Science has so many follies. It's not a very good argument. Also, these ideas were actually held true when they actually took insect wings separated from the insects and tested them, tested their aerodynamic properties in a steady state wind tunnel.
So they take their wings and then like throw them into a wind tunnel.
Yeah, well, they probably have them attached to something, maybe. I just see how they flop around and then throw them in a wind tunnel. So, not surprisingly, since the 1930s, when all of this, the origins of this really crazy concept first came up, Some things have happened. There's been some updates, if you will.
Yeah.
So first of all, the incorrect basic assumptions of these researchers who originally proposed that bumblebee flight was impossible, they've been identified. So the main thing, which you probably could guess by now, is that you can't actually apply fixed wing aerodynamics that we use when we talk about planes to an insect's wing for many reasons. For example, they flap their wings. They don't actually just keep them stationary.
What kind of airline are you using?
Whereas it's not nearly as magical as yours, apparently. So basically, one of the problems was this. Like I said, this is kind of a back of the napkin thing where they did these really basic air resistance mass equations that we use to calculate, you know, trajectory or possibilities of plane flight.
We do them all the time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right now, I'm going to ask for a demonstration.
Okay.
If you guys would like to do it. So first I'm going to ask you to put your two hands out to your sides with your palms down. All right. So this is how a plane looks like when it flies.
It totally is.
Or a fixed wing aerodynamics. So the way this works is when air comes at your wings in a plane, your wings force the air down and that produces upward lift.
Mm-hmm.
So now if we want to compare that, and please at home do this as well, especially
this
if you're listening to this in a public place or in your office. So now keep your hands in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring your arms together in front so that they touch. And when they touch, then flip it so your palms are now face up or towards the ceiling. And then put your arms back out to the sides. And then repeat that full motion. And so basically, this is as physiologically close to bee flapping flight as a human can get. You guys could stop doing it now. Please stop doing it now. They're still doing it. I'm worried. So the difference is that as opposed to with fixed wings,
I can
fly. where you're forcing air down, we're dealing with all sorts of different forces. So you obviously can't compare a stationary fixed wing on an airplane to flapping flight because you're actually talking about completely different types of aerodynamics. And this was best highlighted by Charlie Ellington in Cambridge. He actually traced what happens to air as a moth. I can't remember the actual species of moth, but while it was in flight, it was a tethered moth. And it was not a wax moth.
Oh,
and he actually traced the air to see what insect wings were doing to the air.
Uh-huh.
And so basically what he discovered, or what he kind of was the first one to really document, is called a leading edge vortex. So instead of comparing insect wings to fixed airplane, you know, we're talking about wrong aerodynamics, you can't compare the two. But if you wanted to compare it, you can compare it to like a partial spin of a helicopter propeller, if you will. And it's basically the way that it works is when the insect wings are coming, they form a line of vortexes or vortices in the actual plural, if you will.
Vortices.
Just on top of the wings.
Vortica?
And when the... I'm just going to ignore you. when the wing
Vortice.
Comes... So the vortices are along the front of the edge of the wing. And just like... So a vortex is just like a mini hurricane. And in the eye of a hurricane, you actually have a low pressure system. And so when air hits it, it gets sucked into these vortexes, goes over the wing, and pushes down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to sound all complex, and I'm going to be horribly coarse and avoid all subtleties about physics, because God forbid I'll ever actually understand how this stuff works. But basically, so you've got these vortexes constantly being produced over the flapping wing. Air gets sucked in, and then pushes down, and that produces a lift. So it's completely different than wings actually just forcing the air directly down to produce wing
like
lift.
Like birds.
Exactly, like in many flapping wings. So in most insects, what we're talking about is this leading edge vortex as one of the biggest drivers of producing lift in terms of the aerodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And so a similar kind of similar thing happens with helicopter propellers in that they produce vortexes and use those to actually push themselves up or lift. However, so aerodynamic forces in flying insects are determined by lots of things or influenced by lots of things. So three things I'm going to talk about are wing stroke amplitude. So that's basically how much are you flapping your wings.
Yeah.
So most insects will usually, you'll see like a Drosophila or a fruit fly, for example, will beat its wings. If you compare it from the top of the stroke to the bottom of the stroke, you'll have like 145 to 165 degree angle. You'll have the wing beat frequency also affects the aerodynamics, unsurprisingly, how fast you're beating your wings, and also the length of the wing. So all very obvious things. Also, I should mention right now, too, another misconception is that bees actually beat their wings vertically. They don't. It's almost horizontal, actually. So they beat their wings forward and backwards. So if you're doing that demonstration at home, you were doing it on the correct plane.
Oh, yeah. Which is ironic, considering we were pretending to be planes just before that.
I'm so good at jokes I don't mean to say. However, the problem with all of this current aerodynamics theory Ellington contributed this idea of these vortices in the mid-90s. So again, it was this huge delay from... So there was a really long time where people persistently thought that aerodynamics couldn't explain bee flight specifically. And then in 96, that changed. However, a lot of the concepts like the vortices, were very difficult to trace and measure. They're kind of more hydrodynamic, so because people were looking at them in liquids.
Mm.
And the problem with all of that is that it still kind of slowed down our interpretation or understanding of insect flight, because those concepts were very complex in their fields at the time. However, even with these kind of ideas of this driving vortex lifting insects, bees, you may notice, are kind of fat. They're pretty big.
Yeah,
they bumble. They also have very...
They're obese.
There it is. Yeah, waiting for it. They also have short wings. Also notable is that they actually have small wing beat amplitude. So as I mentioned before, if you compare when their wings up and down, whereas you're looking at flies, you see something that's almost like 180 degrees, right? Almost like a straight line from the up to the bottom of the actual each individual fling.
Mm-hmm.
With bees, you're only talking about 90 degrees. So just over half of that.
So it's similar to what we were doing with our
arms. Yeah, absolutely. Which seems
to
becoming
more and more accurate.
Exactly. We are bees. I'm sorry I spoiled the end of my segment.
It's all right.
So basically what we're seeing is bees have these small wings and they're not even like flapping them that much.
No.
So it wasn't actually until 2005 that everything really started getting hashed out about what was going on with insect flight. And it was done by Michael Dickinson's lab at Caltech. And he used high-speed cinematography of a honeybee in flight, and he also built a giant robotic bee wing to try and change different parameters to see how it was affecting aerodynamics. And this ended up being a great example of a whole lot of things, so I'll try and keep it short as to what I actually want to talk about. But basically, everything we knew about this leading edge vortex, that seems like it was really, you know, it was a really big breakthrough, and it explained a lot of animal flight outside of just insects. However, in bees, it doesn't actually seem to be the predominant force driving their flight. Instead, Dickinson has gone on record saying that it is an unconventional combination of short, choppy strokes. So again, I was talking about they have small wings and they don't flap them that much. But what was really important is that in addition to just flapping the wings, that bees are actually, and a lot of insects and animals, are actually rotating their wings as they flap it. So in bees particularly, there's a really rapid rotation. So when I sign you to rotate your hands at the end of each kind of flap, so bees have this really rapid rotation of the wing as it kind of flops over itself to reverse in direction. And they also have a very, very fast wing beat frequency. Surprisingly fast. And I'll talk about why that's so surprising in a second. So basically all these smaller kind of finer manipulations that we didn't know until... So you can actually go online and look up the Dickinson videos, and there's amazing... highly detailed videos of bees flapping
how,
their wings.
How they kind of did, are they just looking at the motion of the wing, or is there some smoke in there or something to kind of like see?
No, yeah. So this is the nice thing is that in the 90s there was this really big, in relevant to the 2000s too, was there's this thing where there's all sorts of techniques for actually tracing the air, but these people just absolutely traced. They used the high,
actually what you can do too,
6,000 frames per second to actually just trace what the actual motion of the wing was.
If you're in a swimming pool, you can do the same action that you were Dak had you doing earlier, and you can feel the water being forced down, and you can feel your arms lift up if you do that motion really fast in the water. True story.
And you can also feel, so when fish, when they create these vortices down their body, and sometimes if you swim certain ways, you can feel it ripple along you as you do that, and that's what's driving you forward. It's
so
cool stuff.
We are not only bees, we are fish. Human are the hybrids.
We are. I believe that's how evolution works.
So
alien had sex with monkey, and that makes you. Right?
So obviously, yeah.
Tune into episode 2 where we talked about aliens having sex with monkeys.
It does seem
to
be the go-to.
Not enough. We didn't talk about it enough. So
that's
anyway,
episode 5.
So during those flaps, what happens is if you're not getting if that leading edge vortex that you get just by flapping your arms isn't the actual driving force. Dickinson. So Dickinson provides a whole bunch of wonderful, extremely convoluted and complex sounding physics, but I boiled it down to just, so basically there's the addition of a lot of really kind of exotic forces that you don't see all in one species, or you rarely see in the insects at all, and bumblebees seem to use pretty much all of them. So there's, instead of just the leading edge vortex, there's also these strong rotational forces, like I said, when they're actually churning their wings to flap it back. And there's also another kind of like interesting one is that when the bee actually flaps its wing back, it does so right through its own wake of the previous flap, which actually allows it to derive more force than if it was just air that was still. So there was, it ended up being this really kind of complex thing, but Dickinson was able to explain how such force was able to generate to actually let a bee fly. So I mentioned that the fact that bees flap their wings very quickly is also part of it, and that is very odd. And that's very odd because typically an aerodynamic performance of an insect decreases with body mass.
Uh-huh.
And the way you compensate for that is by flapping your wings faster. So again, going back to the idea of the fruit fly, a fruit fly flaps its wings 200 times per second, which is much higher than that of a bigger insect. And that's to compensate for its smaller mass or its smaller body size. However, Dickinson's honeybees, which, as I remind you, they're 80 times larger than a fruit fly, so you would expect a slower flap rate, but they flap their wings at 230 to 240 times per second. So they actually outperform Drosophila. This sounds like a simple solution, but using all of his robotic manipulations and changing like forces and amplitudes, he actually showed that just flapping your wings more in a honeybee is actually insanely aerodynamically inefficient. It's actually like... uses a lot more energy.
Mm-hmm.
It produces a lot more like ripples in the air that actually interfere with yourself. And the simpler solution would have actually just been to increase the amplitude and slow down your wings.
Oh.
Right? So why are they doing this? Why are they, you know, beating their wings at this very consistent but very high frequency? And it turns out that part of the explanation looks like it's actually the muscles involved. So bees look like they've actually evolved a very special kind of flight muscle that controls their wings that fires at a consistent rate. So no matter what Dickinson did to try and change the amount of like force or energy that the bees were going to have to use to actually keep themselves aloft, no matter what, they would never change their wing beat frequency. And that's because they have muscles that are basically programmed, it looks like, to only twitch at that frequency. But as a product of it, they're also really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this trade-off. They develop these very unique muscles that are very fast and responsive, but they can only beat wings at, you know, 230 to 240 beats per second.
So it's not like a human being could just design the same kind of wings and then take off the ground.
No, I would be very impressed if any human could flap their wings once per second with any kind of wing appendage on it. But this is really unique, and this is why this is different than other insects, is what one of the biggest takeaways is from this, is that you don't see this kind of really fast response, high frequency muscle twitching in the wings. Now, he also tried to provide some ecological explanation. So potentially the fact that there might not actually be this much selection against this, because this is, so again, it's aerodynamically inefficient, so why aren't they just developing, why didn't they evolve some other kind of wing?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that Dickinson suggests is that it probably wasn't that much of a selection pressure, and one of the reasons is because, of course, bees eat nectar, and that's a great source of energy, and so there might not actually be that much pressure for them. They might actually be getting more than enough energy. Well, they clearly are getting enough energy to sustain this kind of flight. Also, one interesting idea from the ecology of it is, as David mentioned, these bees are eusocial, and they're also flying, and they're pollinators. So they're not only carrying themselves a lot of the time, but they're also carrying pollen, and a lot of times if they're moving, they're carrying larvae. So they're carrying something beyond their body weight. And most insects can't actually compensate for that. They can't actually change their wing beats or change anything about their flight patterns to actually carry more than their own weight. So to test what would happen if you actually change what kind of force the bee was going to have to drive, instead of just flying them in a normal wind tunnel, they actually fly them in a chamber that was given a very special ratio of hydrogen and oxygen so that the air was actually less dense. And if the air is less dense, there's fewer particles in the air, it's harder. You have to produce more lift to keep yourself afloat, because you're keeping yourself afloat by flying on top of all the molecules in the air. So if there's less molecules there, it's more work. And yep. What did the bees do? Well, like I said, they didn't increase their wing beat frequency because they can't physiologically do that.
And that's why they're killing themselves.
No, instead, they very positively increase the actual amplitude of their actual wing flaps.
Not a boy.
So, not like humans anymore. So if someone was sitting on your back, you would have to somehow figure out how you could bend your arms backwards beyond 90 degrees. Ouch. David's thinking about it. So it ended up being this really cool story. There is definite aerodynamics in exploration or in explanations of this. It looks like there's a whole plethora of new forces that he's now using to design bee robots, of course, bee bots.
And we're all doomed.
I know it's a Y chromosome talking, but that sounds absolutely awesome.
But so he thinks that the ecological relevance of the system is that they're able to support it because of what they eat. Mm-hmm. So nectar is this great high energy food source. And it's also ecologically relevant because they are an animal that at some point is going to actually have to carry more than its own body weight. So they need a flight system that's going to be able to compensate for that extra weight. So a very unique system.
And that oxygen chamber, wouldn't they just be breathing more oxygen too? Wouldn't that give them higher energy?
Yeah, but they wouldn't change the wing amplitude, right?
Yeah. I would if I was in an oxygen chamber.
Well,
you would just start bending your arm farther back than you actually can. So you
get dizzy and fall over.
Also, Dickinson mentions that this is an excellent system of evolution producing a system that's not perfect.
Yes.
It produces a system that's aerodynamically... It's like, no matter what I say, it still is like not the ideal choice of how you would deal with this evolutionary problem.
A hobbled together
and that's
mishmash.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes sense. And this is something that we always should be thinking about and we should always highlight is that evolution should never be expected to produce some perfect result that we think.
It will make some peaks and valleys.
It is constrained by building on what previously came before it.
Absolutely.
Right? So you can't get straight from a completely optimal thing without having to go through a series of routes of paths that might be less adaptive. It always has to improve generation on generation.
Yeah, absolutely. So evolution actually ended up producing this kind of flight muscle they have that's really unique and really restricted in a lot of ways. But it makes sense if you're
neat.
A bee. So Dickinson has provided, this was back in 2005, he provided a ton of interviews because, you know, the mystery of bee flight has finally been solved.
About time.
And now creationists can't use it as a way to say that science isn't goods. But I would like to end it with a Dickinson quote that I think is ironic based on that premise. And Dickinson, after being interviewed, to talk about finally unraveling this mystery, he went and said, "Well, it proves bees can fly. Thank God." And then we're going to be moving over to Dan.
We're going to talk about some killer bees. And that's all I'm going to give you. See you after the break.
Bye.
Forgive me, for I am not acting myself. But these bees in my breath have to come out. Will you give me no reason to doubt your word? But I still somehow...
And we're back. For my segment today, I'm going to be talking about killer bees. Now, when I first thought up the topic of bees, I thought I'd be talking this segment about colony collapse disorder, because that is more scientifically relevant in today's world.
Not my dreams, though.
Well, that's the thing. I'm mostly just a man-child, and so I've put aside colony collapse for that 7-minute intro, and now we're going to be talking about killer bees.
Don't worry, someday the hair will come in.
Killer bees. Killer bees are the products of hybridizing Africanized honeybees and European honeybees, or Western honeybees as they're known.
So what makes them Africanized? They come from Africa.
Yes. And the
Simple.
Reason... Yeah. Well done, David.
Huh.
The reason that killer bees exist, or this hybrid exists, is because some scientists back in 1950s, or 1957 specifically, wanted to hybridize the productivity of the Africanized honeybee with the European honeybee that was in Brazil at the time. They wanted to make a bee that was more productive and more adapted to warmer climates.
Like more productive for nectar and stuff.
Yeah, for
honey.
Honey making, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what happened was, this guy, the biologist in charge of this was Warwick E. Kerr.
A name that will live in infamy.
Yeah, Warwick E. Kerr. As if it wasn't bad that he was called Warwick, he created killer bees. He was in Brazil in 1957, and he wanted to make a productive honeybee for Brazil. And he mixed the Africanized honeybee with the Western honeybee. The problem was, they were more productive, but the Africanized honeybee is much more aggressive and much more defensive than the bee species in Brazil at the time, and indeed in the West at the time.
They were so much more productive, they killed so much faster.
I'm pretty sure this is this guy's entire plan from the get-go, actually. But it wasn't Warwick E. Kerr's fault. Actually, what happened was the colonies, or the beekeeping stations that they had in Brazil at the time, had these grates that the drones, or the worker bees, could fit through. But the queens and everything weren't stuck inside. So even though the drones could fly out, their colony couldn't move or reproduce with any other local bees because the queens were stuck inside this thing.
Even though they were capable of making that decision.
Yes. And so the problem was, though, that this guy, Warwick E. Kerr, had an intern or a research assistant, and it's all his fault because what he did, he took the grates off the colonies. Now, as much as I looked it up, I couldn't find the guy's name, and I couldn't find out whether this was some intentional ploy to get everybody killed. But what he did was he took the grates off, and in the dramatic reenactment I saw, he just picked up the grate and like tossed it to the ground, and the bees swarmed off.
Yeah.
I doubt that's what really happened. I'm sure there's probably some mistake in that he's not just trying to kill people with bees.
This young man grew up, and everyone will remember the name Lex Luthor.
you said this was 1957?
1957,
yeah. Well, you know, like, you imagine that eventually he had to report to Warwick and say what happened.
Mm.
And then Warwick was like, you took the great... Well, at least we don't have to worry about it. I mean, bees can't fly.
That's true.
Only to find out 40 years later.
They took them so long to find them, they're looking on the ground.
And when, what was the guy's name, Dickinson?
Yeah.
When Dickinson said, bees can fly, Warwick E. Kerr, 90 years old, was sitting there thinking, oh, crap.
I've doomed us all.
Anyway, this idiot research assistant somehow lost the grate, or took the grate off, and the hybrid of the Africanized and the Western honeybees escapes, and they reproduce with the local populations, and this is what made killer bees. Why are they called killer bees? A lot of people...
Because they're just really cool guys.
Yeah. Killer Dilla.
Yeah. That's a good name for a band, the Killer Bees.
I'm sure it's out there.
I'm pretty sure it's taken. Yeah. I'm not going to look it up, though.
Anyway. the Killer Bee Gees.
Killer Bee Gees.
My two interests finally merged.
Islands in the Stream. Well, we will fight to the death.
Why are they called killer bees? When I was a kid, I used to think that their stings could just kill you with one sting, that they were that venomous. And a lot of people seem to think that killer bees are more venomous than any other westernized honeybee. That's not the case. They're called killer bees because they're much more aggressive, and they swarm people a lot more, and they're a lot more defensive of their hive. And so the traits of a killer bee, they have some sort of innocuous traits. They're more likely to abandon a hive if it's not working out, and they're more likely to leave a hive in response to a lower food supply, whereas some other bees will try to tough it out for the season. They're just more likely to leave at the time.
And during their childhood, they had a tendency to play with fire and dead animals.
Mm, that's true.
Their fathers were all distant.
They were. Their fathers were non-existent.
That's true. They didn't have any fathers.
This show is
their grandfathers, and the grandfathers were long gone by that point.
But the term killer bee comes from the fact that they're much, much more aggressive and much more likely to defend. So every hive has what they call guard bees, and guard bees are bees that guard the hive from invading species, or from things like humans when they come too close to the nest, or anything that disturbs them. Killer bees have many more guard bees per nest, and these guard bees are a lot more aggressive. Mm-hmm. And they sting a lot of more people and anything that comes close. And in fact, whereas the westernized honeybee, I'll have guard bees that will only follow you up to maybe a quarter mile at at tops. These killer bees have been found to follow people for over a mile, and so they don't forget. They don't let you go.
And they don't forgive.
They're not a forgiving species.
Bees actually can discriminate between human faces, so that's a little bit of a... Mm. They will remember you, and they will come for you in the night, unless your house is completely airtight.
And what they do as well, I mean, some other bee species would probably do this too, but when they attack something, they don't just stick to the surface. They try to get within the mouth. They try to get within the esophagus, and they'll go into your ears, and they sting the inside of your throat if they can. And this is what causes a lot of the deaths. It's not so much that... they sting the surface and their stings are more venomous, but they're stinging in greater numbers and they're getting into your throat to sting.
When you go on the wrong side of killer bees, they don't just kill you and sting you. They sting your whole family.
They'll kill everybody you know. So that's killer bees, and that's why they're called killer bees. Now, this hybrid was created in 1957, or at least it was... released, and they escaped, I suppose, in 1957, if you want to put it that way. But that was in Brazil at the time. The killer bee strains quickly spread throughout South America, but Americans didn't really pay any attention up until they started migrating a bit north. And they migrated slowly because, remember, they're adapted to more tropical climates, so the farther north they push, the less adapted to the climate they're going to be. But as of the last couple of years, they have been found, well, actually, as of 2002, they were found in several of the lower states. They were found in throughout the southern hemisphere, but also in Mexico, and then in Texas, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Florida, and Southern California. And there are more and more reports to indicate that they're adapting a little bit more to colder climates, and they're pushing farther north.
So how safe are we here in Scotland?
They're not real likely to fly across the ocean.
Up until recently, we didn't think they could fly at all. So, that's true. We have a history of underestimating bees.
The jury's still out on their swimming capabilities. But we have talked about how similar they are to fish, so that's true.
But Warwick E. Kerr might be visiting any day now, so he'll probably bring them with him. Or and his
he's
research assistant.
No longer a man, he's just a bee.
He's a vessel.
He's just a bunch of bee balls in the shape of a human.
I don't know how he got hard. I should point out, if anybody knows Warwick E. Kerr, I'm just throwing out misinformation
about
him.
I'm sure he's probably...
I don't want him to blame him for the deaths of innocent people. Again, it wasn't him who replaced the greats. Yep. Well, if Jurassic Park taught us anything, it's not to go try to create things in nature that aren't supposed to be.
But also, it tells us that regardless of whether this young supervillain had taken the grate off, the bees would have got out anyway, because life finds a way.
Life does find
violently,
a way.
Violently, terrifyingly at times, it pushes through boundaries, it's a horrible destructive force.
Life finds a way.
And confirms our previous suspicions about the flying capabilities of a T-Rex.
Exactly.
A very cohesive episode today. Again, Warwick E. Kerr was just trying to create a more productive honeybee for the southern hemisphere anyway. But they're pushing north, and there have been some studies now that test the climate capabilities of killer bees. And they have found that they can survive up to 23 degrees Fahrenheit. So as Zach said earlier, sometimes bees will sort of cluster, and for thermoregulation purposes, they cluster and move around. And in fact, honeybees can kill wasps by surrounding them and clustering them, and more or less, I guess, burning them by clustering over top of wasps. These killer bees have been found to be able to cluster and survive temperatures as low as 23 degrees Fahrenheit. So 23 degrees Fahrenheit is well below zero anyway, and that does suggest that in a pinch, in a bad situation, they could survive in much farther north climates.
Or
now,
if the bees coalesced together into some bee structure, they could survive the colder temperatures of Scotland, perhaps in the form of some kind of man bee, like Warwick E. Kerr. Is that what we're getting at?
I'm sorry again, Warwick E. Kerr. I know you're probably trying to do the right thing. You had bad hiring practices, though.
And you made killer bees.
Yeah.
Don't hire someone called Dr. Colossus. That's always a bad move.
These killer bees, now, are they really that big of a threat to human beings? The answer is yes.
No.
And
they have, No, because they're bees, if you look up the list of the top 10 phobias, which are hard to compile, you'll always find bees somewhere in the top 10. So people are naturally afraid of bees as is, and when you put the term killer bee out there in the public, it's going to cause a bit of a mass panic. So they're not responsible for millions of deaths. But they are responsible for some deaths, especially in recent years in, again, these southern states, and it's causing a bit of a stir. Again, they won't let people leave if they've disrupted a nest, and they're another thing about the killer bees is that they're much more likely to burrow. They're more likely to have their ground or their hives underground, and so when people are out there cutting their grass, this happened to me, not with a killer bee, but if they cut their grass and run over a bee nest, the bees come flying out, and as opposed to regular bees, these bees don't forgive, and they just sting the people, and that's caused quite a few deaths in the U.S. now.
I like all those honeybees that forgive you. Oh, you were cutting the grass? I'm sorry.
Genuine mistake, bro.
It happened to me twice. So I remember in a summer a couple of years back, I was cutting the grass every Saturday for this woman. And twice in a row, I ran over the same bee's nest and got stung. Because I'm an idiot and I don't learn. The killer bees, though, they wouldn't have let me make that mistake twice.
Killer bees learn. And they adapt.
So that's the story on killer bees. They're aggressive, and they're coming to get you. They're coming north. I should say, before I slander the killer bees anymore, there are species. So Warwick Eaker was trying to make a productive honeybee. There are species that they have found now in Brazil that are Africanized, but are much more docile. They're not quite as aggressive. They are productive. And so in some senses, I think Warwick Eaker and the biologists responsible for producing the killer bees have produced a gentle, docile, productive bee down south.
How, if we were faced with killer bees, how would we defend ourselves? Just to know.
That's a good point.
You curl up in the fetal position on the ground, and when it gets close, punch it in the nose, and then swim away.
Its nose is tiny. It's going to be very difficult to do that.
But
then you don't deserve to live.
So I did come across a list of how to avoid getting killed by killer bees.
Oh, here we go.
Don't flail is one thing. If you can find a body of water, it is best to jump into it, but they will hover above the water and wait for you to...
Oh my god, it's terrifying.
Another thing that seems to have helped people in attacks is just falling to the ground, covering your face and your ears with your hands. So you'll get stung on the body, but you can usually survive those. Again, they're not more venomous than most bees, but that will stop them from entering your throat and causing your throat to inflame and basically suffocating you. So you can fall to the ground. Probably your best bet is to just go inside, but that's not always an option.
Bottom line, don't flail, but maybe use a flail.
Yeah.
Maybe use a flail. On a more serious note, one of these guys in attack, he was documented to have 4,000 bee stings in an attack by killer bees. He survived. This was one of the guys who...
He survived, but he is now the queen.
They now call him Bee Master. He was one of these guys. He didn't actually mean to do it. He sort of fell after being stung so many times and just put his head in his face in his hands, and he thought he would die. He was stung over 4,000 times, but he survived that attack. But yeah, killer bees. Probably best to not run over their nest with a lawnmower.
Warwick, we'll never forget you. Because we can't. You've cost us too much. And on that note, we're going to be taking another last break and then going to David for a final segment. Do you want to tease anything about that?
No.
All right, we'll be back.
Okay, and we're back. I've organized a loosely defined fun section, which I call A Taste of Honey and a Barrel of Bees. Anyway, so what this is similar to some past fun sections we had. It's going to be two different rounds.
Similar to past sections, this is also going to be fun.
Well, we can only hope.
Be sure to tune into episode 3 where we had two different quizzes in our fun segment.
And also tune into episode 3 where we had fun.
Did we?
No.
So two different quizzes again. We'll start with a barrel of bees. I'm going to give you guys a word, starting with the letter B.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, and see if you can come up with...
You're talking about the alphabet now.
Okay. Wordplay. So let's play with some words.
Be gentle.
Okay. First of all, brontide.
Just being brontide?
Brontide. This is actually a really good word that you don't get to use very often.
See, a brontosaurus, like a brachiosaurus, is very tall.
Yeah, how do you spell it?
B-R-O-N-T-I-D-E.
T-I-D-E.
Brontide?
Brontide.
That sounds like some sort of metallic alloy.
It's the time... Okay, so I'm just going to have to give a background in case... Because we're here to inform people. When the moon goes around the Earth, at certain times, the gravitational pull from the moon draws all of the brachiosauruses out of the water and onto the shores.
It makes
en masse.
So Zach is actually closer.
Oh,
yes.
The brontide is seismic rumbling that sounds like distant thunder.
Oh, that is a good word.
Yeah, what did I say?
You said metallic alloy.
What did I say? Wasn't that it?
Bibble.
Holy book?
That was wonderful.
More bees. B-I-B-B-L-E. Bibble.
The holy bibble.
That must be French for library.
Oh,
it's got something to do with books, I bet.
It's what you put around your neck before you read.
I thought you were going to make a hanging joke again.
But to bibble is actually its verb. It's to drink too often or to drink and eat noisily.
Oh, like imbibe.
Yeah, imbibble. It's to imbibble.
And the final one in this first round of guessing the B words is barognosis.
I'm going to need the spell.
Barognosis. B-A-R-O-G-N-O-S-I-S. Barognosis.
Barog, meaning barometer. Or barometric. So...
Is it referring
prognosis
to
on the atmosphere?
I hope that is referring to taking the pressure, measuring the pressure in a region.
It is the ability to perceive weight.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think we nailed that one. I think you'll find.
Anyway,
partial credit.
So second is a taste of honey. So I've got some bee facts, and they're actually not about the letter B this time. They relate to bees that we've been talking about, and I want you to tell me whether they're true or whether they're false. Are they a bee myth? Or a bee not myth.
Or a bee movie starring Jerry Seinfeld.
Which
I'm pretty sure is about
killing
bees.
All of the above.
So,
or do we have too much time on our hands?
Honey contains less calories than white sugar.
I'm going to say...
False. I'm going to say false.
Honey contains fewer calories than white sugar?
Yeah.
Fewer calories, I'm going to say true.
It's actually false.
Damn
it contains slightly more. Although it's basically the same.
How come girls put honey in their tea as a form of like health?
Because they're misinformed.
Oh,
because they sell it in fancy bottles instead of
ratty
old bags.
It's no more, no fewer calories. So bees transfer nectar to each other by kissing and chewing.
That is true.
I think that's true as well.
It is true. It is possibly the most adorable part of the honey story. I couldn't think of it. I don't want to make it a myth. I don't want to get that out there. The bees kiss the honey to each other. So consuming older batches of honey is being claimed to improve rashes and skin diseases.
Well,
and by improve, you mean spread them.
I mean, get rid of them.
Oh, then false.
I'm sure...
No, it's totally
back
true.
In the day when they used to drill holes in the head to
so,
cure the cold. I'm
after
sure
I wrote an article... for a website on the Edwin Smith medical papyrus, which is an ancient Egyptian medical papyrus, and honey was used for its mild antibiotic.
Yeah, I'm sure that was
property.
True,
so I'm going to say true.
Also, I don't
think
you were
Dan.
Capable of coming up with that on your own if it was false. So true.
Wrong.
Oh, it's because it's old, isn't it?
It's not just that it's old. It wouldn't necessarily improve rashes. What I'm actually describing is a property of urine.
Oh, there it is. David's weekly urine segment.
It also, you look up the health benefits of urine, it'll have some very detailed descriptions of how to make yourself healthy by using your body's own best medication.
And then you can look up the social benefits. Oh, wait, there aren't any. I'm so alone.
It bonds you with other people who drink urine.
I'm a misunderstood monster.
Right. Bumblebees... generate static electricity as they fly, which helps them pick up pollen.
I'm going to assume false.
I think it's false too, because they think they've got like hairs on their feet that they can attach pollen to.
It's true.
I knew it was going to be true.
It's bumblebees.
What am I, 0 for 4 on this?
So, because bumblebees have all this fur all over themselves.
Yeah. Makes sense, yeah.
They generate, so the pollen actually sticks to them as they are entering the flower.
Nah.
Oh, isn't that nice?
You know, a lot of people think that bumblebees can't sting, but they can.
And finally, to...
Here's another story about how much I hate bees.
This is why we're doing bees as a topic. Dan has a grudge.
Yeah, he's been waiting. There's a reason he picked this.
Finally,
this pencil is yellow and black.
Medieval historians believed that bees emerged from the body of a dead horse.
Medieval historians?
Not like the ones that are around now. The people writing down histories and facts.
Some friends who are
medieval
historians.
Medieval scholars
sure
who are writing these stuff down.
I know for a fact that David has misinformed us previously in this episode when he talked about how the motivation for a waggle dance towards a new home site wanes regardless of the quality. But I still know that there's at least like a good 10 bees out there that have been waggling their whole life to point out a freshly available dead horse. I say that they were both correct and that it is true.
People used to believe a lot of stupid things back then. Let's go with yes.
It's false. It was a dead calf. Hornets come from a dead horse.
Of course.
Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, bees.
So, yeah.
Or
dead calf.
I hope you'll learn a little bit about that and you will bibble less often as you listen to
So if they do a waggle, if they do a waggle dance towards a dead calf, does that mean they're revealing the best...
They don't lay their eggs in it. They actually thought that if you just left a dead calf, bees would emerge from it.
No, I was just trying to make a joke about veal.
It reveals.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Hang on. I'm going to be quiet. Say it again.
So that concludes this week's episode about bees.
I think before we end the episode, I should go off with the famous words from Confucius. When the bee waggle dances towards a dead horse, is it signaling the horse or the hornets?
See you next week, everybody.
Bye.
Be seeing you.
I hate. Yeah, I know. I still hate. This is our science podcast. It's about bees killing himself and David being an asshole.
How am I being an asshole? Apart from with the paper, yeah, that's pretty asshole.